Hello, it's Neil Channing here. You may not have met me before. It's nice to meet you, Simon. I'm a professional gambler. I've been a professional gambler since as long as I can remember, really. I certainly can remember gambling at the age of 10. I think before that, my gambling hadn't really taken off. I'd certainly used to bet on marbles and I was big into trading football cards when I was about eight, or stickers, Panini stickers. Other stickers are available. And yeah, I liked to win the other kids' marbles, but I didn't mind if I lost. I was always a good loser at marbles. We used to do that thing where you try and get them in near to a hole without dropping in it. That was quite a good one. And then yeah, I guess we started playing shoot pontoon, I think, when I was in the Cubs, or maybe the Scouts. Be prepared to lose a lot of money at that game. And then after that, it was football coupons, I guess. I think I was about 16 when I put one over the counter in a Mecca betting shop. I don't think I can be arrested for that anymore because Mecca don't exist now. The manager probably can't be arrested either, so that's good. And then a friend of mine, his father used to go racing quite a bit on a Saturday, and he started taking us to Kempton and Sandown and Epsom. We lived quite near Ascot Racecourse, and on a Monday night, I would cycle to Windsor, which was 6 miles away, and go and bet the last favourite, which seemed to win every week. It was often a Henry Cecil horse in a graduation race. They were brilliant. If you went in the silver ring, you could get evens, even though you knew it was 4 to 6 in the Tattersalls. And I think I learned tic-tac just so that I could see that it was 4 to 6 inside, and we were getting a bit of levels, you devils. So that was good value, and I was like that. I would generally go with about 9 quid in my pocket. And I'd mess about having 50p on the other races and then have like £6.50, or if I'd made a profit at that stage, maybe even a tenner on the favourite in the last. The whole week would come down to how that went on. I think I was still under 18, don't try that at home, kids, when I was going there. But from the age of 18, I guess I'd been playing a bit of poker. Yeah, I think. My sister's boyfriend liked to play poker, and him and his mates used to come round our house, and my mum would let us play, and sometimes to one of their houses. Yeah, they were quite interested in drinking and smoking and pretending that they were having sex. Not during the game, obviously, but they talked about those kind of things. And me and my pal were a year younger, or 2 years younger, and we literally just went there to win their money. And we generally did okay. There was a lot of snooker played at that time. I was very bad at snooker. I would say my highest break around that time was probably about 30 or something, which was ridiculous considering the number of hours that I put into the game. I was very much, I was a bit of a boring player. I was a grinder. I liked to put people in trouble with a lot of safety play. There was always a lot of argument over the handicap between about five of us that would play regularly, and sometimes golf as well. We used to go to a par three golf course, there was one guy who was terrible. We used to give him 2 shots a hole, and we could still beat him. He used to think that was a brilliant handicap and he could win a lot of money, but I guess the stakes were not huge. We probably played for sort of 2 or 3 quid on a hole, maybe a five or sometimes, and maybe a tenner over the whole round. But it was big enough for a 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old kid. I didn't go to the casino till I was about 20, maybe 19. I'd been going to the dogs for about 2 years at that stage, but going to the casino, I felt like if my mum ever found out, I'd be the disgrace of the family. I'd already told her I went to the dogs, so I don't know why I thought the casino was so much worse than the dogs, but I used to go to the dogs at Reading and sometimes at Wembley. There was a time actually when dogs was the big love of my life, and I would go to Portsmouth on a Friday, Reading twice a week midweek, Wembley on a Monday, occasionally Wimbledon if I just couldn't think of anywhere else to go. And yeah, that was a bit of a passion. And poker sort of crept in, yeah. I guess going to the casino maybe once a month for a poker tournament, sometimes once a week. There was a time where it was once a week. A fiver rebuy was a big tournament in those days. And if somebody spent sort of 30 quid in that, they were considered to be an absolute lunatic. I would generally go with 12 quid and try and get away with spending 10 on the tournament and save £2 for a one shot at the blackjack.
Okay, Neil, so how did you make the transition from being your average mug punter to a bit of a master punter?
Well, I don't know about that. I think I might still be your average mug punter, actually, but there's definitely been times where I've felt like I'm a master punter, and they don't always last, those times. I went to university, and I punted pretty solidly there, certainly in the second and third year of that. I would be in the betting shop most days, and I was the bookie. I was the bookie at uni. I used to take bets from about 12 different people. I mean, you know, don't try this at home, kids. It was all totally illegal, and I didn't have a license or anything. You know, what are you going to do? So arrest me. It was a while ago. And yeah, I left college with money. You know, like, I actually had money. I kind of, you know, obviously we had a brilliant time then of not having to pay fees, and I actually got a grant. But yeah, most people leave college totally in debt, and I left with about $5,000 or $6,000 to my name. Which was brilliant. I thought I was a millionaire, really. And I started going to the races every single day. I say every day. I mean, they didn't have racing on Sundays then. And I would probably go 4 days a week. And I would drive around the country and go. And I definitely thought I was a top pro punter. I wouldn't say that I knew everything about gambling. I was quite ignorant about horse racing, really. I was learning. I mean, if you sat me down and asked me to explain exactly how horse racing worked and the pattern and handicapping at that time, I don't think I would have really understood all of that stuff. And actually, there was way less information out there. There was no internet. You know, I used to kind of get a time form annual and spend a lot of time looking at that, like hours and hours and hours, and writing stuff out on pieces of paper. But yeah, and like, yeah, I guess the Racing Post was around, maybe at that time. And I was a big reader, but there wasn't that much good stuff you could read. I think I did a couple of books I really enjoyed. I think the Alan Potts books I liked, Against the Crowd, one of them was called. And Mark Coton, the original Price Wise, he wrote a good book, which I really enjoyed, called Value Betting. And I felt like I learned a lot from those guys. But I got to about 27 years old, and I'd literally done nothing. I mean, I'd never had a job. I'd gone racing most days of the week. If I wasn't at the races, I was at the dogs or playing snooker or playing cards or going to a snooker tournament. That was another thing I used to do, and go to golf tournaments around the UK. Mostly because you could bet there. There was a availability of betting and no tax to pay. Because we had betting tax, of course, then 10%, and it went down to 9%. So, yeah, I mean, it was hard to be a winning punter, of course, because of the tax. I mean, very few people win enough to cope with the ups and downs of life and pay all that tax. So going racing was kind of, it was compulsory, really. It was the only way that you could make it pay. I wasn't really, I mean, I did it for 7 years at that time, and like I say, I started with $5,000 or $6,000 that I'd left college with. In 7 years' time, I still had $5,000 or $6,000. I mean, I'd had a brilliant time. I'd lived in hotels, and sometimes I had a flat that I was renting in London, and I was traveling around. My car was doing 150,000 miles a year. It was pretty mental, and I had a brilliant time, but I was dedicating myself to my craft, I guess. I was just that was all I did. I just gambled every single day on one thing or another. And then one day after Martin Pipe killed me, basically. Martin Pipe, I was laying his. I used to do a bit of laying to a couple of the bookmakers on course sometimes. So if they laid a horse at evens, I might give them 5-4 or 11-10 if I thought it was going to drift and I didn't fancy it. And yeah, there was a day when Pipey had 6 winners at Wincanton, and he might not have had all the winners. I think there was 6 favourites, but like most of them were his. And then he had the first 4 the next day, and I basically just went out of business over those 2 days. And I called up my parents and I said, you know, I'm not really doing this anymore. I can't afford the rent in London. This is bad, you know, 27 years old. I had to call them up and say, like, can I come and move in with you? And my dad said, yeah, well, you know, the rules of the house are you have to get a job. You know, a 3-letter word. And I applied for a load of jobs with no intention of getting any of them. I went to an interview to work for a tobacco company as a traveling salesman, persuading newsagents that they should switch to their brands. And when it looked like I was about to get the job, I said to the guy, he said, well, you know, have you got any other ideas about how to expand the tobacco market? And I said, have you thought about hanging around outside junior schools, handing them out? And I think I'd have got the job if I hadn't have asked that question. So I must have not really wanted to work, I guess. But yeah, I can tell you when I feel like I kind of, because in that time, I never really felt like I'd cracked the game. There were days where I felt like, God, this is it. I've got it now. I'm just going to be rich forever. This is so easy. But generally, it was a struggle. I was always looking to just gradually increase my tank and bet slightly bigger. And, you know, I had a small tank, really, relative to the amount of expenses I was paying. And it was hard to build up my tank and keep taking money out just to live on. And it wasn't really until I got a job working in spread betting, which happened, you know, at the age of kind of 20, 28 or something like that, that I was getting a regular salary. And I basically had time to sit and watch sports and racing and gambling all day long. And also the other brilliant thing about that was we would run off printouts of how the customers had done in the previous month and break it down sport by sport. I mean, this was all quite antiquated computer stuff. It would come out on a massive wodge of green and white striped paper with names, you know, printed on, and it would take 5 hours to run the print thing. And I would be itching, waiting over the printer to look. And I'd say, this guy's winning at golf. And I can see where he's winning on match bets. Let me go and look at the last 20 match bets he had. Can we see if there's any particular golfers? I mean, I think if you work in a bookmaker these days, they don't really let you kind of do that kind of thing. But I'm sure they, I mean, it's all computerized now, I guess, that they, but I was really keen on breaking down how people are doing and why they're winning. And I learned a lot there. And yeah, I there was a couple of quite smart guys that worked in spread betting at that time, a lot of smart guys actually. And I got involved with a few of them in some gambling, and that was probably the best time, really. I mean, we made a lot of money betting on horses, and to an extent where, you know, if I'd have really pushed it, I probably could have quit forever at that point and not really had to do much else again, work-wise. And actually, a couple of them did that. And I'm still grafting away, so I'm obviously not a master punter. They're much cleverer than me.
So then for a period, I hear you actually poacher-turned-gamekeeper and became an on-course bookmaker for a while. How did that pan out?
Well, that was, yeah, that was a kind of, all of these things really overlap. I mean, I you know, like I said, I left college and I went to the race course, and, you know, I was fascinated by the on-course bookmakers. When I was like 18, 19, 20, I would frequently go racing and just stand in front of one or two particular bookmakers that I respected and just try and learn what they were doing. I learned tic-tac. I learned how to clerk. you know, writing, standing behind, writing the bits down before computers and whatever. And yeah, in the time when I was traveling around the country going racing every day, I got to know a guy reasonably well who was a bookie at the Dogs. And he was a bit, I don't know, he was a bit in and out of money, shall we say. And he said to me, oh, do you want to be a partner in my thing at the Dogs? Which basically meant, would you like to bring all the money along and use my pitch and we'll split any winnings that you make? But if we lose, he wouldn't pay anything. So it wasn't probably a brilliant deal, but he was a nice guy. And I learned a lot from that. You know, partly don't go into business with people that you meet in pubs randomly. But he's a lovely guy, actually. But I got to know a lot of the bookies at the Dogs who were also at the races. So then I got to clerk for some of the bookies at the races and do a bit of work on the floor and stuff at the races. And when I did have that period of being broke and I had to move back in with my parents, the first thing I did was go to the local dog track where my parents lived. And one of the bookies there was a guy that I knew from the races, and he gave me a job working for him twice a week. So that got me a bit of pin money. And I met a fella there who went on to be a great mentor of mine, who I'll talk about a bit later. But yeah, I think it was before that, probably. I was at the races at Ascot one day. And I, like I say, well, you know, I lived, that was where I was brought up. So I always went to Ascot most meetings. And there was a bookmaker, and we went in a very cheap enclosure for Royal Ascot. It was called the Heath then. And now they've turned it into some kind of nightclub in the daytime or something. I don't know what the hell they're trying to do there. But it was £1 to go on the Heath. It used to be 50p. I remember when they doubled the price. It was controversial. And there was about 12 bookmakers there. And it was very... you know, it was pretty low rent, the whole thing. There was a fish and chip van, I think, and a bar. And yeah, the average steak was probably £2 that people were having. And this guy was trying to take bets resting on his knee in pencil while he updated the odds on his board in chalk and gave out the change and the tickets. And I went up to him and said, look, you look like you might be struggling to manage to multitask all these jobs. And he said, yeah, my mate was supposed to clerk for me and he never showed up. And, you know, do you want a day's work? So I started working for him and I said, well, look, I'll do it, but I want to have a bet. You know, I've come here to have an afternoon out and have a few bets. He said, well, bet with me. And somehow I managed to bet 4 winners out of 6 races that afternoon. And he thought I was absolutely the bee's knees. So he said, well, actually, I'm a bookmaker, but I've got these pitches and I have to go once a year just to keep the pitches. I'm not really interested in being a bookmaker anymore. I've got a proper job now. I joined the waiting list years ago and whatever. Would you like to run my pitches and pay me some kind of rental? Now, this was completely frowned upon by the Bookmaking Association. But we didn't worry about things like that. So immediately I said yes, and I was now an on-course bookmaker. He had the license and had to stand up and do all the stuff. After a while, I got a license of my own, actually, and we joined all kinds of extra waiting lists. And then they brought in this thing called the extended supplementary, which meant that if you were way down the waiting list, number 754, and you were going to have to be 183 years old before they let you bet at Royal Ascot, you could now turn up on spec, and if there weren't enough bookmakers there on the day, you were in. So we started driving around the country totally on spec, just going to places and turning up and standing in the back row at Lingfield and all kinds of places and taking, you know, Thrupman's Halfpenny a race. But I thought it was brilliant. I remember one birthday I went to Lingfield on the all weather. And we took £200 on the favourite in the first race and it got beat. And I just thought, what a brilliant birthday this is. We had champagne to celebrate. And that was considered to be quite a big bet in those days. And then one day in 2001, I think it was, it might have been 2001, I think, they decided they were going to totally deregulate the on-course market. All these old boys that had been bookmakers for years wanted to get out because they were old now and they didn't have sons or brothers to leave the business to, and that's what you had to do if you wanted to pass it on. And they were holding on, hoping to sell their business. And now they said, well, okay, we're going to change the rules. You're allowed to sell your business. And all these old bookmakers sold their pitches. And we decided to spend some money, me and this mate of mine. And we spent quite a large six-figure sum on a whole bunch of pitches all around the country. And it was great. It was great. We'd had, you know, we'd been doing it for 8 years off and on, sort of 10 or 12, 15 times a year. And then when the extended supplementary, we've been going 40 times a year. So we felt like we'd learned our craft a little bit. And now we were having some front row positions. And it was amazing. You could take money now and like you didn't have to kind of scream out 11 to 4. You could just leave 5 to 2 on the board and people would come and have a bet with you. And we did very well for about 2 years. And then everything started to go a bit wrong. Mobile phones became more prevalent. The internet became more of a thing, so people became much more aware of what prices were available with different firms. Debit cards became a thing, so you could have an account with lots of bookmakers now without having to have credit, so it was much easier to have accounts with a dozen bookmakers. People started getting satellite TV a lot more than they had before, so now you could watch At The Races and Racing UK. I think Racing UK was going then, but you could certainly watch a lot more races at home now. And tax and betting shops went, so they did away with the 9% in the shops. So all the reasons that you had for coming racing were beginning to disappear one at a time, and the main thing, of course, was the machine came in, Betfair. Started in the late 99, and it really didn't take off straight away from an on-course bookmaking point of view, but it started to dominate the ring in about 2002, 2003, and I started to realize that we were taking half the amount of money, a third of the amount of money that we were taking before, and the percentage of gross profit that we were making was down by two-thirds. And we were big layers. We used to employ like a whole bunch of people, and suddenly it just wasn't a good thing. And the last year was particularly painful. We had a pitch at Cheltenham, and there was a year when I don't know, like an untold number of favourites won. I think it was 14 favourites won across the meeting, and there was a Glorious Goodwood that was pretty similar in the same year, and. Suddenly we'd gone from being the kings of the castle to scuttling out the back door. So that was a bit of a low point, really. Very painful.
So another string to your bow back in the day was spread betting. I understand you were right involved from the very start with that.
Kind of the start, yeah. So around the time where I basically went broken, scuttled back to live with my parents. I actually got a regular office job for a short time, the first time I'd ever done that. But I used to work at the Dogs, and there was a guy there who was a great mentor of mine called Martin Johnstone. He's still the bookmaker, the main bookmaker at Paul Dogs. And he was somebody, you know, he's a little bit older than me, but we're roughly the same age. And we spent time talking about gambling, and we liked snooker, and we used to go to snooker events. And he said to me one day, this is amazing, you know, that in the sporting life there were these spread betting companies advertising. And he said, well, I just think they make a lot of mistakes. And he had an account with one of them, which was IG Index. So they don't do sports spread betting anymore. And he said to me, oh, you know, they're doing some racing and stuff, and they haven't really thought about what they're doing enough. And I've been having some bets with them, and it's really good. So I basically started betting roughly my annual salary on a daily basis. And that was a bit hairy. I mean, I didn't earn very much. It was a rubbish office job, really. And I was working for like a quasi charity that could barely afford to pay me. I would sort of sneak out at lunchtime and have a few bets and come back and find out if I'd won my annual salary. And one day they advertised for a job. They needed someone to work in City Index, which was the oldest of the spread firms. They'd invented spread betting on sport. And I went to work there. It was the most lunatic place ever. I turned up for my interview and 5:30 p.m. I'd driven 90 minutes to get there. And just as I was arriving at the office, some people were leaving. And the security guy said, yeah, that was the fella you were meeting. He just left. And so I had my interview at 12 midnight because that was when they came back a bit drunk from an evening out. It was like five people came back. And the fellow that was interviewing me asked me what football team I supported, and I sort of supported Arsenal, so I said that, and it turned out he was a big gooner, so that basically got me the job. Then he said, do you know Martin? And I said, yeah, I do. And he said, yeah, I think I've seen you with him. And it turned out we'd met at the snooker a couple of years before, so that really did it. Then I got the job basically on the strength of that. They told me the first 2 weeks just sit in front of the cricket every day, really, and read the papers, and don't do anything, don't ask any questions, don't be a nuisance, don't get in the way, and definitely don't answer the phone. The first day I answered the phone, I took a bet, and I just did what everyone else had done. I watched carefully what everyone was doing, so I read the price off the screen. The guy asked for a bet. It seemed reasonable to the amount of bets that people normally were having, and then I reported to the guy who was running the market that this guy had had a bet. And my boss said to me, why do you take a bet from him? And I said, well, because he's got an account and he asked for a bet. And they said, well, okay, some advice now. In the time that you work here, your job is to never take a bet from that man ever. And if you do, you'll be sacked. So I said, well, he's got an account. And also we had a policy that we didn't ask people their account number before we gave them the price. So it was cricket he had a bet on, and he asked for the total runs. I said, they're 300, 320. And he asked to buy 50 quid. And everyone else was betting 50 quid, 20 quid, 100 quid. So I thought it must be all right. It was within his credit limit. So I said, yeah, you've got a bet. And from then on, I had to learn how to quote prices to people without knowing what their name was. So I had to recognize the voices of all the regular customers. I had to guess which way they were going to bet and try and move the odds slightly one way or the other. And then if I guessed the wrong way, I had to tell my boss that I'd got it wrong. So yeah, it must have gone all right, because I worked in spread betting for 9 years, it was a fun thing. I learned a lot. There were some very smart people that worked there. We certainly, between us, and I wouldn't say it was me, we were responsible for ruining at least five bookmakers, like completely just put them out of business, like mostly the early online internet firms. And I'm not saying that was just the people at the companies I work for. I mean, there were some very smart guys at Sporting Index as well. They were our big rivals at the time. My main claim to fame in that time was that I invented the bookings index. I was very proud of that. And I hate to think how many people have been turfed out of their house for losing money on the bookings index in their lifetime. But that was all down to me, guys. Sorry about that.
Okay, now some more generic questions here. Now, do you specialise in specific areas in gambling? And as you're successful, how do you manage to get on?
Definitely, I mean, in terms of gambling, I've done every kind of gambling. I mean, there was a time where I did blackjack card counting. There was a time where I was just massively doing each-way burglary. I literally never had a bet unless it was a bad each-way race. There were definitely times where poker was my main thing, and I, you know, 2007, I played 310 average 14-hour poker sessions in the year. So that's quite sick, really, if you think about sleeping and eating and stuff in between. So yeah, I do change from one thing to another. You know, spread betting was a big passion of mine for a long time. After I stopped working in that industry, I kind of stopped doing that really, but I mean, I used to do that every single day, and I would look at the spreads all day long and think about very little else. There was a year in 2006, it was about an 18-month period, where I literally just would spend 20 hours a day on Betfair, putting up markets and laying stuff. I was basically a robot without any software. And that was, yeah, that was quite mad. I put on about 7 stone in a short space of time and made myself really ill trying to lose the weight way too quickly. That was a bad thing to do. Don't do that, kids. So I do specialize, but I go from specializing in one thing to another thing. Right now, I'm betting a lot of football. I would say roughly half of my turnover is on football in a year. And that's purely to do with getting on. I do a lot of NFL. I would say that's probably about 20% of my turnover, and horses about 30%. And horses I've changed. I mean, it's certainly not possible to just open the paper at, you know, 9 o'clock and think, right, I'll just do all my bets for the day right now, and that takes 10 minutes. It usually, and I certainly don't consider looking at the racing the day before and trying to do some bets, because what's the point? You're going to get, you know, 50 quid on, and the prices are going to collapse, and you're not really going to be very satisfied one way or the other. So I tend to try and bet later. I don't really have a bet on the horses much before noon ever. I tend to stick to the kind of races that allegedly people want to play in. So I really bet much bigger in the big meetings and on Saturdays, and midweek I probably just have a couple of token bets most days and don't really spend much time. Well, I spend time on it. I still watch a lot of races, and I'm quite sad actually. I'll just have 20 quid in a race when I'm watching it, just for something to watch really, which is a bit sad really. I should be able to watch a race without betting on it. If I haven't bet on a race, I quite often don't even watch it actually. So that's a bit bad, because you should watch the races and try and learn for the future. But the racing the way it is these days, you know, there's a lot of horses and there's a lot of races. There's too much racing, I'm sure. But if you are betting mostly on Saturdays, you can focus on a smaller pool of horses. If you only look to horses that are rated 80 and above, you probably could save yourself a lot of time and effort, because in those lower grade handicaps, it's quite hard to get on. With football and American football, I'm it's the internet now. It's a worldwide thing. I'm sending money to all parts of the globe, basically. Use exchanges a lot, and I've basically tried everything. I mean, I still haven't found anything that's definitely working all the time. I mean, I used to send people to the race course. I used to go racing all the time. I used to send people out in betting shops. I used to get people to open lots of accounts online. I used to use all kinds of intermediaries. I've tried to cut down a lot of that now. I tend to do things that take... I want the time that I spend putting the bets on to take less and less, because it's quite annoying, and dealing with so many people is just... There'll always be somebody that lets you down.
Well, now, I'm assuming, as most punters have found out to their cost, you still suffer bad losing runs. How do you deal with those sort of things mentally, and has your passion for gambling affected other areas of your life negatively or positively?
I'm having a bit of a losing run at the moment, and it's still painful. It's generally a pain having a losing run, in that when you have other people putting bets on for you and stuff, you have to keep sending money, transferring money back and forward. It's a pain, and obviously there is just the, you know, oh my God, I lost again. There's always a feeling in this game, I don't think you can ever crack it. The game changes all the time, it gets harder. You know, I remember the stuff that I was doing, for example, with the exchanges with Betfair really in 2000 and, six. I don't think I could do that anymore. I don't think it's possible. I think there's less liquidity there now, and that's definitely changed. The stuff I was doing in spread betting in the early days of that, that's definitely changed. I don't think I could go back to that. So you have to keep moving on and find new angles and edges. I think at the moment I've got quite big edges on certain things in horse racing, but they're starting to erode, and I feel like they're going to go, so I need to benefit from them now. In football, I think I've got an edge that will last quite a while, but you know, it's quite a small edge, and it means I have a lot of losing days, and it's very up, down, up, down, and that can be quite wearing. I mean, you know, I had a really good day a few days ago, the best that I'd had for like 3 months on the football, and then I followed it with the worst day I've had for like a month. So, you know, if you really allow yourself to be euphoric and depressed, I think it makes your life quite a lot harder. I think you have to be quite level-headed, and you have to just kind of arch an eyebrow and say that's quite nice when you have a winning day, and kind of turn down one corner of your mouth when you have a losing day. I think if you jump around the place and go crazy on the winning days, the come downs will be a bit too much. I think there are some positives when you're winning over a long period of time with losing runs, because it does actually make it a bit easier to get on. I mean, with horses, I've got a few quite trusted people doing most of my business now, and right now they're saying to me, oh, it's brilliant, you know, like they get a cup of coffee when they pop in the shop and stuff, and there's a couple of accounts that we've got where they probably think we're absolute mugs at the moment, and hopefully you know, they'll be wondering about whether to send us a hamper at Christmas when we win a load back in the next 2 months. In terms of my personal life and the way it's affected that, I mean, you know, it's a miracle really that anybody from the opposite sex would be at all interested in spending their life with some kind of deranged, lunatic, degenerate. But I was quite lucky to go through a succession of complete nutcases before I found one complete loony woman who seems prepared to put up with me on a daily basis. So I think that's quite good. I think if you have a relationship, it can keep you level-headed. She doesn't really gamble. She doesn't actually really like gambling very much. I took her to the Arc de Triomphe a couple of years ago, and she took a book and never really stopped reading it during any of the races. She liked the lunch, and you know, that was the main highlight. We went racing to Epsom, and she took a book there as well, and we only went because Blondie were playing afterwards, and I think if Blondie weren't playing, she would have said, why the hell have you brought me here? So she's basically has zero interest. I mean, I sometimes say to her, this one's really big, why don't you cheer the red one on the left, and she'll be like, well, that one there, and I'm like, no, that's purple. And then they've already crossed the line by the time she's worked out which horse it is. And she sort of says, like, I really don't want to be involved. And yeah, I did take her. Actually, I've got a quick funny story. I did get her to do, she's French, and I got her to do a bet. She used to go in the shops for me years ago. She didn't do that anymore. If any shop managers are watching and worrying about French women in their shops, it's not her. I did send her one day, Paddy's were doing a thing on the Grand National, six places on the Grand National in the shops, and they were a bit under the odds on every horse, so it wasn't really very good, but there was one horse that was quite fair to back each way. I didn't particularly fancy it that much, but it was a fair bet with the six places, and I thought it would probably finish the course, so we might as well back it. And I sent her down the shop, and there was quite a big Paddy's near where we used to live, and I sent her down there, and she'd never been in there before. And they had what, you know, what they call a floor walker on Grand National Day, a bloke who was wandering around looking for total novices to explain to them how betting worked. And he said, oh, you know, can I help you at all, madam? And she said, yes, I'm interested in the Grand National. And she probably doesn't have that bad a French accent, but it was that kind of thing. And the guy said, oh, yes, well, we have a special coupon to fill in. So she's like, oh, good, coupon. So he said, well, which horses that you want to back? And she said the name of the horse. I forget what it was called. And he said, oh, okay, that's, you know, no, he wasn't French. No, he said, oh, okay. So this is where you put the name of the horse, you cross by the side of the horse. So just write it there. So she crossed it and he said, well, would you like to take the price? So she said, oh, yes, I know about that. Yes, I want to take the price. So she takes the price 16-1. And he says, well, do you want to have a win or each way? Now, he starts to explain then what each way is. She says, no, I think I know. Each way is when we have two bets and one is to place. And he says, that's absolutely correct. Yes, so you tick that box there, each way. And he says, now we have to tick the box for the stake. And it can be from 25p each way and upwards. So how much would you like? And she says, she reaches into her pocket and pulls out a wadge of 50s and says, £600 each way. And he had to get a new coupon. It didn't go up to 600 each way. They laid the bet, sadly, and the horse was unplaced. So it was a bad story, really. But I like to think that that was quite amusing for that fella at the end of the day.
Okay, Neil, well, thanks very much for all that. Quick questions for you. Poker or horses, if you had to choose between the two?
I don't know. I mean, some days I wake up and it's poker. Other day, well, like, you know, like the day before the Cheltenham Festival is like Christmas, birthdays, everything. But then the day before Alaska is the same. And the day before the World Series main event, the World Championship, the 10,000 buy-in event, is exactly the same. They're all things where I won't live long enough to enjoy enough of them. And, you know, I kind of want them to happen every day. So sometimes it's poker, sometimes it's horses. I guess when you're winning at either, it's that. When it's a quiet Thursday at Southall, it's poker. And when it's some rubbish tournament at Luton, then it's horses. So, you know, they're both equal passions, I guess.
Okay, so just talking to you, you can tell that your brain is forever going, looking for new angles, new things, or at least it seems like that. Do you ever manage to switch it off? How do you relax and forget it all about
it? At home, my setup is a big kind of thing on one wall with TV screens and computer screens and piles and piles and piles of racing posts, because I never throw them out until I've read them cover to cover, which means that I end up with three-year-old racing posts that I read on train journeys occasionally and throw them out. I never really move from that spot from the time I wake up to the time I go to bed, generally, unless I'm going out and doing something completely different. So in between races, I'm playing about with Twitter because I'm an addict of Twitter, @SenseiChanning. But I do like to sit back at the end of the day. Like yesterday, for example, I think I bet my first soccer match at 11 a.m. and the last one kicked off at 8 p.m. So about 10 p.m. I was done for the day. And I tweeted every goal, which is bad, really. I mean, that's like not good for you, probably. But 10 p.m. I put a movie on. I like watching old movies. And that one was it was quite a good movie, actually. To Sir With Love, from the 70s or the late 60s. I hadn't seen it for years. I like to watch films that I've seen before, like something like Casablanca. I've probably seen that like 150 times. And I find that really relaxing. I love detective things as well. Morse is brilliant. And I've really enjoyed Endeavour. That's been great. I'm rubbish with box sets. Like, my missus will watch the latest stuff. I mean, I still haven't got around to Breaking Bad yet, so that's a bit poor.
Okay, and hopefully there's some aspiring young Neils who want to be professional gamblers watching these videos. What would your advice be to those people?
Funnily enough, I saw your thing you did about Big Deal, and I guess, you know, I was kind of an aspiring Robbie Box when I was younger. I mean, I was already, that was my life, basically. It was, they suddenly made a TV show of my life. I think so, anyway. I sort of remember it as being something that I didn't watch until I was already doing it. Although maybe I was still young at the time. I can't really remember now. Maybe I was only like 14 when it was happening. I'm not sure. I would just generally say the same as my mum probably was thinking at the time I was watching Big Deal, don't do it, like, because it's hard. And if you're smart enough to get a living out of gambling, you're probably smart enough to get way more money out of something else. Most of the people that have done really well in poker, you know, sort of 5 years ago, have gone on to do something, you know, maybe in the city or in business, where they've made way more money because they have the right kind of brain to do that stuff. And I think that's quite a valuable lesson. But for me, you know, I'm unemployed and unemployable. I guess I'm going to stick with it. I have a friend who, you know, he's kind of retirement age and he's still doing it and he's been doing it for years. And he's just going to do it till he drops. And I guess that's where I've got to now. I don't think, even though I'm probably going to live a few more years, I can't really see me doing anything else now. And it's going to change a lot. The internet's changed it. Lots of the things that I'm doing now won't be around in 10 years' time. And maybe I'll run out of new angles and I'll have to think of, it'll be bad if I have to get a job at the age of 60. I don't know. My advice would be try and do something else first and do it as a sideline and write down all your bets, study how you're doing and how your bets have gone and think about the sample size. Don't run before you can walk. Don't get carried away. 97% of people are losing, 3% are winning, and of the 3%, only about 20% of that 3% are making enough to make a living. If you're capable of being in the top 1,000 people in the country at something that takes a long time and a lot of effort to do, there's probably something else that pays more money than being a gambler.
You can follow Star Sports on Twitter at @StarSports_bet, our Facebook page at @StarSportsBet, and also view all our latest videos on YouTube at @StarSports. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.